back to the DC Hospital Association Continuing Education Initiative for the Improvement in the Treatment of People Who Use Banned and Non-Prescribed Drugs in the District. We are continuing today with our conversation about peer recovery coaches and peer services in the district. I am very lucky to have with me here today Thaddeus, who's one of the DC area peers, who's going to chat with us a little bit about sort of his role in peer treatment in DC, what that means, and how we can all sort of work better together to sort of help people access treatment a little more easily. Okay, so Thaddeus, I was hoping you could walk us through a couple of sort of cases to, I mean, I sort of know what your role is and what sort of what an encounter with that you have with a patient looks like in the emergency department, but I know you're in a lot of different settings. So I was hoping you could just sort of go through a couple of cases with us to sort of talk through what does your job look like on a day-to-day basis. And then from there, I'm hoping we can figure out ways that we can make each other's lives a little bit better. So if you'll humor me, let's say we're in the department together, the emergency department, and I'm on a night shift and I have a suspected opioid overdose come in. They'll say 3 a.m. I know you're going to be there at 6, right? So we'll say one of our sort of standard cases is a patient's found down with paraphernalia around them. They pinpoint pupils, unresponsive, or given intranasal Narcan with EMS and are brought to the department. They get to me, you know, I do my medical screening, they're breathing, they're still sleeping. I don't need to give them any further naloxone. Like they're safe. Their respiratory rate's fine. So we're just going to let them sleep until the morning. So when you get there in the morning, if they're waking up a little bit, what does your encounter with them? Can you just walk us through what that looks like?
Sure. I think every encounter is a give and take, mm-hmm. and everyone is different and unique in their own way. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I will try not to wake them up. I never get good results when I wake them up.
Fair.
When I approach them, I let them know first and foremost that we don't have to have this conversation, that I am not a doctor or a nurse. I have lived experience. I spend some time establishing rapport with them, letting them know I'm not the police, letting mm-hmm. them know that they're in no trouble at all. Letting them know that I have the lived experience and I've been in the bed before and, you know, sharing personal stories briefly with them to say, I understand where you're coming from and let me qualify that if they're open to it and receptive to it, can give me enough time to build that rapport to then find out what they were using, the amount, the quantity, the dollar amount per day. All comes into scope. Have they experienced withdrawal before? Are they going to be going into withdrawal in the next, you know, let's say 12 hours or so?
Sorry, this is truly just for me, my education. When you're asking, I mean, I know that like when I'm thinking about loading buprenorphine, I sort of think like, is this a low dose user versus a high dose user? Is that sort of what you're asking about when you're asking about the amount they're using or the dollar amount? Like what's your...
For sure. I mean... So it's pretty much a guarantee that there's going to be fentanyl in the heroin supply in DC. Mm-hmm. And then there are also your outright fentanyl seekers and users. Mm-hmm. And you have people who use it intranasally and snort it, or mm-hmm. you have people who inject it. And those are wildly different things.
Right.
Right. To get an honest answer of, yes, I'm injecting, you know, $60 a day on average. And I will be in withdrawal, and I have tried Suboxone before, and I have been to treatment 4 times. To get that picture is extremely important as to what the next part of that interview is going to be, what the next step is as far as bup administration in the ER.
Like, what are we trying next, and like, how severe of a disorder is this right now?
Very much
like,
so.
What have we tried before that we need to try differently this time? Things
Very
like
much
that.
So. Yeah. And it's all a huge give and take because okay. you can have the patient that's, you know, interacted with peers in the past before and already just off the cuff says, no, mm-hmm. I'm good. I don't want to talk to you. We're good. But you can also have the patient that is open to trying something new. You know, mm-hmm. I tried Suboxone before. It made me sick is what we hear all the time. Mm-hmm. But with the right approach and, you know, a kind of a caring and gentle approach to it, they might be open this time to, let me try something different. So
I really don't want to derail this with, you know, my soapbox. I really don't want to derail this. I do think it's worth just stating here. I mean, I know we get a lot of those patients that are saying, I've had Suboxone before, I've had a bad experience with it. What kind of conversation are you having with people at that point?
I mean, I always hit them probably with the same thing you do of, have you ever heard of precipitated withdrawals? Uh-huh. Well, this is what that is. Uh-huh. You probably experienced this before if you took it too early. These are the, you know, this is what happens when precipitated withdrawal occurs. The symptoms you're explaining to me are very, very consistent with what a precipitated withdrawal might be. So here's how we get over that here, if you're willing to entertain that as an idea
right
today or a solution today.
Right. And I mean, I know that's, I mean, it's got to be a different conversation sort of coming from you versus coming from me. Because I mean, I think, I know you and I have had this conversation. I think I've said it here on the podcast before of like, if I know someone's had a history of precipitated withdrawal, I can go into the conversation with like, listen, the literature says precipitated withdrawal is more common at these lower doses. It's more common if we start it too early, things like that. And I can say as the person that's going to be prescribing the medication, this is what I'm going to do differently this time. And I'm going to tell you from the literature, this is what probably caused your symptoms. And this is how I, as the person who is gatekeeping you from your medication, am going to do to try to keep it from happening again. And what I'm going to do to, you know, if it does happen, how I'm going to make you feel better. But I mean, it's got to be a, you know, a little bit of a harder conversation when you, you know, you sort of know what a lot of these risk factors are.
I can look them in the eye and say, I've been in precipitated withdrawal before. I know right. exactly these symptoms because I've felt them and I've, you know, felt how acute they can be myself in my body, you know,
right.
like there's just something else to
having been there,
yeah. knowing and them knowing, you know, right next to you that they know what you're talking about, that gut level, like I've felt it in my soul before thing.
I know it's scary. I know it's a risk, but
it can break down some yeah. walls. And again, it can establish and strengthen that rapport to the point where they might be open to trying something different than they haven't tried right. before.
So, and you don't have to answer this, of course, but if in your, my, you know, my, I've told you this, my approach to precipitated withdrawal and sort of the approach from the, at least the most recent literature is to give more buprenorphine, right? To get those receptors loaded. Is that an experience you've had? Like, have you had sort of those rescue doses of buprenorphine to try to get you out of precipitated withdrawal, or did you sort of have to tough it out?
I had to tough it out. This is all trial and error when I was a user. There was a,
fair.
There wasn't nearly as much research or knowledge uh-huh. to what it is now, you know, 7 years ago as to where we sit today. But I do have the benefit of being able to tell the patient mm-hmm. that there is this strategy that mm-hmm. if it doesn't feel great at the dose we start you off with, we double down and mm-hmm. you should be out of the woods. And that's what the research says today.
Right. And I think that's like the DC wide. I know the OSAR committee here through DCHA, that's their recommendation, is to double down, to repeat the dosing until you feel better. So that should be something that hopefully every provider in DC and every hospital in DC knows that, like, if you do precipitate this withdrawal, that we are sort of committed to giving those extra doses until you feel better.
Very much so. And then I'd like to follow up with, and if it's not that that's causing you the uncomfortability, well, you're in the hospital and we can handle that too.
Right. Yeah.
But there should be a way out of this.
Yeah. We've got all the things here. Yeah. I mean, and I guess, yeah. I always put this on a tangent, so I apologize for that. But have you had the experience where the patient is maybe willing to try it, but the provider is concerned about their history of precipitated withdrawal, or they're concerned about those escalating doses?
Yes. I mean, there's always bureaucratic red tape involved. There is a lot of factors. And then there's ultimately the patient's willingness is another factor. I've had patients say yes to the bup and it takes 2.5 hours to get there for mm-hmm. some reason.
Yeah.
And they're gone. And,
yeah.
and it's heartbreaking to get to that point and realize that they may never consider that as an option again, because it took too long.
Yeah. You know? I mean, that's one of those things. Like, there's so many, I think you're right with the red tape. There's so many just regulatory barriers. Fortunately, a lot of those are coming down, but so many just administrative barriers to sometimes getting buprenorphine because there's been so much regulation around it for so long and people are just so afraid of it. So if you have listened to any of our prior episodes, the X waiver is gone. DC has a policy that pretty much every hospital in DC should have buprenorphine available to be started from the department. So don't be one of those administrative barriers, please.
It's a very good thing.
Yes, very happy. Okay, I derailed that. I apologize. Let's bring it back. So you're assessing this patient to see if they are a candidate for buprenorphine in the department. Then what happens?
Like I said, it's a huge give and take of what the patient's willing to disclose, what they might be willing to do differently than maybe they've done before. If they do get dosed, I prefer to continue motivation and continue saying, okay, well, if you're willing to do that, how are you feeling? How are you willing to consider treatment? And if not that, how about we talk about harm reduction? How about we go to the next level and say, what are you doing with your harm reduction, your needles, your fentanyl test strips, all of the above?
Yeah. Safer injection, safer smoking, all of those.
But it really, it depends on how the give and take goes and where the patient decides to take the encounter from there.
Right. I mean, ultimately, I think probably the peers are much better at this than most of the rest of the medical setting. Like, it is about what the patient wants and what the patient's ready for, and not just like, again, us being paternalistic saying, you need to do so and so, you know.
Very much so. And I mean, so if we get that far, I then offer my OSOP list and say, hey, community outreach is available. Buy you a cup of coffee in a week or two if you want to talk. Provide my resource information and this kind of the same treatment information we may give to someone if they might change their mind, you know?
So just whatever level of resources they want. Like if they want just to go and maybe they have your card and maybe they call you for a cup of coffee in a week versus if they want to go somewhere to be assessed to like go into treatment same day, just sort of
correct.
Like you're connecting them.
Yeah. And if they do engage, then, you know, on the community side of things, we do go over, like we mentioned earlier, you know, IDs, like, do they have an ID? Do they have the things that they're going to need to get them to the next level as far as stability goes, just some total.
And I know one of the things that sort of has come up in the provider literature a lot is like the best practice with buprenorphine is if we start, we really like to do the warm handoffs, right? Where we have someone going directly to, like, they have an appointment made from the department, they know what provider they're seeing, they know when they're seeing it, and they, like, ideally, like, as a provider, I'm sending them with enough medication to get them to that appointment. And you're sort of ideally the role that sort of facilitates that, right?
The liaison, yeah. If you will. It's that can be tough too. I mean, the DC has a fast track provider directory. Mm-hmm. It is antiquated. It is at least 2 years old. I've been on this job for 2 years now, and it's older than I am on the job.
And people come and go from treatment centers, so it's hard.
Addresses change, and phone numbers change. And so in another facet of my OSOP job, I do community outreach with providers. So right. I talk to available providers who will kind of let me in the facility, have an open conversation of how does your intake process go, what are your hours, that kind of thing, so that I can then relay accurate information to the patient.
Right. And I believe, and this will be in the show notes, I believe the fast track provider list, there's at least one available on the DC Health website, so we'll link that. And then I think the different hospital systems also probably have their own internal list of providers. So take a look at the DC Health site if you are, as a provider, looking for those resources if your peers aren't around. And then ideally, I mean, it sounds like we talked about this a few minutes ago, but you're sort of this master list, right? Like, you are the resource that sort of knows all these things that we can't always find on Google.
It's a dangerous allegation, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, I know from trial and error what works.
Right.
You know, like, I always point to certain providers and say, I have good results with them.
Right.
Because I've had, you know, the trial and error there.
Right. And that seems to be sort of the common thread from the peers I've talked to from other sites is like, feel like everyone has like those one or two people where I'm like, I can always get this person in at this site. This is the, you know, and I think there is sort of some sharing ideally amongst peers of what works and what, you know, what numbers are updated and things like that. But you definitely have that field of knowledge, that base of knowledge that I don't, as the sort of the, like the doctor in the ER. I wouldn't have any idea where to send people.
I hear you. I mean, the another facet of the peers is having that peer network. Whereas right. if I don't know who to talk to about, you know, mother baby bupe dosing or whatever it right. is, I know that there is another place in Maryland that I can call and talk to a peer there who has actual experience with it, and that whole network of peers.
Right. They'll know where to send people
when it's working properly. Yeah. We should have enough resources between all of us to get anybody, you know, quickly to where they need to go.
Okay. So my goal with that, and I think you did a great job of illustrating it, was that you have this, and we keep coming back to this knowledge base and this skill set and this role that, you know, we definitely don't. And I, as sort of the focus that I want ideally any provider that's listening to this to sort of take away is use your peers. Don't abuse your peers, but this is sort of a great resource with this sort of field of knowledge that, again, I mentioned a while ago that I didn't learn about. I didn't learn sort of how to interact with peers when I was in medical school or even in residency, or sort of what your role is. So I want to make sure we've got that sort of highlighted. I wanted to do another case because I tend to make things all about the emergency department, which I'm sorry for, but I probably won't change. So I do want to do an inpatient case because I know you're doing so many things. You're doing the ER, you're doing this community outreach, but then you also see pretty much any patient that screens for high risk substance use on the inpatient side as well. So how does that sort of look different? So if we'll return to sort of our case format, if we've got like a patient who was admitted for something, let's say unrelated, something medical, and they go into either like opioid withdrawal or alcohol withdrawal while they're inpatient sort of on the floor. Like these are the patients that we sort of see, like obviously alcohol withdrawal is really like medically risky. We have like high risk of against medical advice, discharges, things like that. So when you're sort of going called to see those patients, what's your approach like?
So the hospital I work at is a liver center. So we do see a large volume of alcohol related, severe cases. And as you know, just in general, I mean, alcohol being the more socially acceptable thing, mm-hmm. Legal and accessible. It requires a different approach. Mm-hmm. I mean, an understanding, you know, I don't have necessarily the lived experience with it. However, personally, I use AA mm-hmm. as my pathway to recovery in my own life. And mm-hmm. I know, you know, the literature there, I know the steps to recovery quite well in that sense. However, then you run up against people who have been in, you know, active alcoholism for years, and they automatically turn their nose up and their ears are shut off when you mention the words AA. Mm-hmm. So really it is default back to motivational intervening, establish rapport, figure out the life, you know, the life parameters that got them there, mm-hmm. And let them answer their own questions. You know, what other options do we have right now to address alcoholism or other substance abuse in general than substance abuse treatment? You have, you know, Vivitrol, which works, naltrexone and Vivitrol, which work, you know, well for alcoholism mm-hmm. and as well as opioid use, mm-hmm. A lesser utilized option for opioid use as well.
I want to have a talk with you one day about naltrexone. We'll have a long talk here. I'm going to try not to distract it today.
Okay, that's another podcast.
We'll have a separate. We'll bring Thaddeus back. So I mean, I know, and you have like a longer period of time with patients who are inpatient. So if they're, you know, not sort of the first day you go see them, if they aren't really interested in talking to you, but they aren't saying, you know, get out of my room, don't come back. Are those people you see again the next day, be like, hey, how are you feeling today? Anything changed? Anything you need? Or is it like once they sort of say no, you're done for that encounter?
I try and follow up as best I can with every patient that I encounter, especially inpatient. You do have that captive audience, which is nice. you get a lot of the kind of the source material for where it's going to go and how it's going to go in your first encounter. Mm-hmm. But on the follow-up, you know, talking to people about how, you know, how do you feel after our talk the other day? What are other options in your best thinking? Are there other than treatment or the fellowships of AANA or some of the tools like buprenorphine or naltrexone that we have? It can reopen that conversation, you know.
Do we have sort of like non-AANA, like the, like I know the SMART model and sort of these other like more secular models of addiction
Dharma
community?
And
like,
refuge
we
and
have
SMART.
A we have good network in DC or
no?
A little bit less so.
The populace for sure is NA and AA, like certainly overwhelmingly, they're just much smaller, mm-hmm. and with that, you know, smaller pool to fish in, you get less people in less a smaller sober network and a less potential that someone is actually going to like it, use it, mm-hmm. and benefit from it.
Yeah.
So they are there, absolutely, yeah. and a lot of people are averse to AA and NA and the higher power thing, and
right.
they're it's necessary,
right? Yeah, I know. You know, I think the one of the things that sort of comes up with AA is because there is it's such a huge network, is that there's a sort of like a subset for whatever demographic or whatever sort of like identity you sort of want to look for. I feel like there's an AA for every group.
Everything.
So that sort of seems like maybe with these smaller communities of these other paradigms, it's like they're there. They're like, if you want to go to these other sort of treatment modalities, they're available, but it might not be quite as like demographically tailored.
I agree. And so a lot of my patient encounters kind of end on this kind of note of, mm-hmm. if you want to go and get, you know, get sober and get recovered, mm-hmm. these are available, mm-hmm. but you probably would have done that before.
Right.
You know, your best thinking got you here in the bed as with repercussions from substance use and alcoholism. Mm-hmm. So we're going to recommend that you get into some sort of substance abuse treatment,
right.
of some level of some kind,
yeah.
to put the guardrails up, to have other people who are knowledgeable about this, give mm-hmm. you their suggestions and their care while you're there, and set you up to get into one of these fellowships, to surround yourself with sober people, to then enjoy a recovered life, which has very little to do with the drugs and alcohol that got you here in the first place.
Right. Try something different this time than what you would have already done as an outpatient. Okay. So you're seeing the, you know, patients on the floor in general. Obviously it's, the hospital stays are all going to vary, like how long they're there and sort of like what level of care they're going to need when they discharge, both from like a medical perspective, you know, will they need sort of like a further medical like rehab, anything like that. I guess, oh, I remember what my question was. The sort of the concern for me that I've seen some up in Baltimore a little bit more than in DC is people with you know, just responsibilities like jobs or families or taking care of things like that. A lot of people don't just don't have the life that allows them to go to the sort of protected like residential treatment for this sort of protected period of sobriety like you're talking about. You know, I know there's not like a perfect answer and this is not a one size fits all
sure.
answer at all, but I mean, sort of how do you, what's the middle ground, right? Like if you can't be in this intensive outpatient or you can't be like in a sort of a residential treatment, we're still connecting people to like, I know we're connecting to medication assisted treatment. But then we're also connecting people to like therapy and to sort of like obviously AA groups or SMART groups or whatever they want. Sort of what's your middle ground between that?
That's a difficult question. It's
right.
definitely a case by case question, but I totally agree. I mean, this is why the motivational interviewing is so integral to what we do, you know, learning about how many children they have, what their employment status is, you know, are they underwater with their bills or their mm-hmm. mortgage or stuff? This is all incredibly relevant to, yeah, you should go to residential treatment. Or no, you qualify for outpatient treatment, or you can't do either of those because life is really, really hard right now, or you're not willing to, you know, what's the next step to that? So right. that really the give and take that I've been talking about is getting them to the point where they're willing to do something other than get back home and sit down on the couch and hope that recovery comes to them there.
Right.
Like imparting with them that recovery is an action. It is a verb that has to, you know, requires action to get to that point. I think that really sums up the role of a peer recovery coach, though. I mean, you have to let them know that recovery is something that you have to chase after, just like you chase after the substance, and motivate them to get to the point where it's like, well, yeah, it's not going to come to me on the couch. I need to try some of these options and resources that have been provided to me. Otherwise, you know, I'll go back to the drink or the drug and end up back in the emergency room or worse.
Right. And whatever thing like is, you know, keeping you anchored that keeps you from being able to do this residential, that's a motivator, right? Like that's the thing that, you know, whether it's a job or a pet or a family member or loved one or whatever, like that's also the motivator for why you can't keep
very much
sort of going on this way.
Very much so. I mean, especially we see a lot of the alcoholics that, you know, aren't willing to do the residential treatment, that aren't willing to go to AA. And we kind of, oftentimes we'll leave it at, if you don't do any of these things that we have available for you, what is left?
Right.
You will go home. The statistics say overwhelmingly, you will drink again, mm-hmm. and you will be back through here if you're lucky, you know, right. for some of our more chronic patients. So, again, it's left at their feet of you have a choice to make, and this is 100% your choice. But in the hope of getting better here in the hospital, you know, we encourage you to choose the right thing.
Okay, we only have a few more minutes with you today, Thaddeus, so I want to quickly go over sort of, we all have hard jobs right now. I think that's like, it's not a secret to anybody. I think healthcare, everyone's having a pretty tough time right now. But I do think a lot of the sort of the ways that we make our, like each other's lives harder, we just do because we don't quite understand where we're coming from, what our roles are sort of, and how to necessarily communicate and interact. So I wanted to just quickly go through what can we, and I say we as, you know, physicians, nurses, PAs and Ps, you know, like the sort of the clinical, like medical side providers do to help you and your colleagues as the hospital-based peers. Like how can we make your lives easier? How can we work better with you and sort of vice versa?
I think kind of to bring it back to how you and I met, mm-hmm. We kind of quickly bonded over Bup, mm-hmm. and it was a short 5-minute conversation. It really was.
Always talk about Bup.
I mean, but that's what, you know, to take 5 minutes to say, hey, you know, I see you around all the time. I've heard your name. You're a peer and just, I see you, you know, acknowledging that we're here is a huge thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, to just say, how's your day been going?
Yeah.
Have you had any challenges? I know y'all are incredibly busy, and as are we. But that's a double-edged sword. It goes for the peers as well to go get out, be visible, interact with the physicians and other hospital staff and say, we're here. You know, I think it's to show interest in the environment around you is a huge leg up.
And that's one of our goals with this, right? If like, I mean, like we keep saying, I didn't really know what a peer was or what your role was. And obviously like I hopefully know now, but that's sort of one of our things is like, we need to understand what your value is and sort of your expertise. And then I also need to know who my colleagues are, like when I'm in the hospital, right? Like we need to take that time.
Very much so. I mean, I'm experiencing this, you know, kind of still as we roll out inpatient. You see a doctor's name enough times and then you'll interact with them briefly. And before you know it, we're messaging on Teams and uh-huh. can you come and see this patient? And you're getting, you know, the appropriate referrals because you've established, you know, the relationship, the working relationship with them. And then I'm comfortable enough to go up to them and say, hey, I don't understand what this terminology means or what this diagnosis in the chart means or what that means to the patient's physical recovery as a barrier to getting them into recovery. So it all works together if we all work together,
right.
which is easier said than done because like we discussed, we're all busy and we all have a lot to do. I do think that taking that little bit of extra time and just saying, well, what can we do to kind of get to know each other's roles better? That goes very much for the peers to have a willingness to learn, to have a willingness to adapt and be in that medical environment and understand medical jargon. And
I mean, I think what you're alluding to is something that I sort of never thought about until we had one of these conversations, was that most peers are not coming from a medical background, right? Like, you're working in the hospital setting, but you're not a medical provider per se. Like, you're providing a service in a medical setting, but you don't have the terminology classes and you don't have the, you know, I know you do all the HIPAA training and all of the OSHA, you know, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But as far as like, if I come in and I'm like, oh yeah, they have an SIH on CT, well, you know, like all of this jargon, that's not necessarily a language that is accessible or even significant to you. The conversation is, this person can't talk to you right now. Like, they're intubated, they have a tube in their throat, they're on a breathing machine. Why don't you reassess them when, if they're extubated, you know, and just even defining what those terms are. Cause I think people do come into peer work from a lot of different backgrounds, like professional backgrounds, educational backgrounds. And I think we as, and I'm very guilty of this, but we as doctors get like sort of like wrapped up in our own, like, we forget what is common medical knowledge and what isn't, and where you can bring sort of the conversation to a level that's accessible to both of us.
100%. I'll leave you with a quick story.
Yeah.
When I first came in, you know, I have a rudimentary knowledge of just medical terminology, just from being as old as I am and kind of living life and being in the hospital, yeah, or whatever it is. But I didn't know what BIBA was, you know, brought in by ambulance. I didn't know what syncope was. Like, yeah. There were little things that I had to humble myself and either Google it or go up to the charge nurse and be like, what is this? Because I see this a lot. What's going on here?
Yeah.
I think that there's a significant learning curve, and you get used to those terms. And then there is all of the other ones that you haven't even experienced yet. But it can be, I won't say belittling, but it can be an eye-opening experience when someone's talking way over your head and you have to say, hey, can you slow down for just a second?
Yeah.
Let me, what is that? What does that even mean? And what does that mean to the patient as far as what I'm trying to tell them? So understanding where we come from as a role, what our goal is, you know, what we're trying to assess and all of that, from the doctor side, learning what a peer is, and then from the peer learning what a doctor is, you know.
And something that we talk about a lot, and I talk about in just like my day-to-day life about the ER, is that the ER is the closest thing to a flat hierarchy, probably anything in medicine, just because we are all like in the trenches together, right? Like, we know we're all right there. But that sort of sounds like what you're saying. If like, I mean, you are my colleague, and when we're working together, like, we're working together with the goal of caring for this patient. And I think it, to a certain extent, I think a little bit my instinct is, if I'm speaking to someone that I consider like my professional colleague, I speak a little more jargony than I would to a patient, because I don't want to seem belittling by, you know, like dumbing it down for you. But I'm not dumbing it down for you. I'm speaking like, you don't have the same training and just the jargon I'm using. Like, you're clearly a very like educated, very intelligent person, but it's not belittling to put this in layperson language. I almost feel like it's more belittling to like gatekeep it with all this jargon and force you to ask. But then I also just think that something that I've sort of seen in some conversations is the, and actually there's some papers, I'll link a couple in the show notes, but sort of the experience of peers of have felt as though they've been treated as lesser than by other members of the clinical team. I'm hoping you haven't had that experience. I assume probably you have, because doctors can be the worst sometimes. But I think that's something from our end of, we need to sort of police ourselves on a little bit of, you know, you're a member of the care, like, you provide at least as much, if not significantly more value as I do in the sort of the care of people who use banned substances and who have substance use problems. And I think it is something we just have to please ourselves of, like, you know, I need to not be a jerk to you, and you need to feel safe enough working with me to come and be able to ask me the questions you need for your success and taking care of our shared patient, you know? what else can we do? What are the, are we consulting you inappropriately? Are we expecting unreasonable things from you? Like what else?
That's a big question.
Sorry.
I think system-wide, one thing that I would like to just put out there on the podcast is that, you know, marijuana these days in the district is just as legal as alcohol. Mm-hmm. So how do we define problematic marijuana use mm-hmm. as a totally, as a, you know, provider and as a peer here, like, are we wasting our time with that? But as far as, you know, physician staff to peers goes, I mean, I think there have been times where I might have felt maybe slighted or overlooked, but as I've been there for 2 years in this role, and I think as people understand the value of what a peer can do and achieve here, with the kind of the common goal of, hey, if you can resolve this substance abuse issue, you can reduce recidivism, you can keep this patient alive, you can, you know, saving the hospital money is nowhere near on my radar, but that is a fact. That I think that's the proof is in the pudding, though, of if you chart people for a long enough time, people will say, hey, there's value here.
Right.
And I think given enough time, the role of a peer can have a significant impact on those recidivistic, you know, instances and the new patients, the patients that have came in that have never heard of what recovery is in the first place.
Or harm reduction even.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a great point. And I mentioned in one of the background episodes that there's a thesis out of Hopkins that suggested that it was specifically looking at peers in an OSUP program saved the hospital like $1.1 million just in opioid related hospitalizations and hospital stays in the course of a year. Like it's huge cost savings, significantly more, I'm sure, than they're investing in the peers themselves. But I think, you know, looking at this as physicians and as hopefully, I mean, ideally we'd have some clinical leaders sort of listening to this, like the idea that we need to invest in you as something that not only has this like really intrinsic value to patients that like really improves patient satisfaction, really improves retention and treatment, sort of all of those things, but also like actually is good for the hospital. It saves the hospital a lot of money. And, you know, this is always a hard conversation for me to have because it's partly like, it's intuitively obvious that we should have people with like a lived experience who are able to sort of narrow that trauma and, you know, reduce the trauma experience by people who are seeking medical care for complications of their especially banned substances. But beyond even that intrinsic value, you can make a financial argument. I don't want to have to make a financial argument, but if it comes down to it, yeah, you're financially viable in the hospital as a resource that we should be investing in. And you're, you know, and hiring peers and developing peers and retaining peers and building sort of like these improved treatment systems that you can keep doing the work you're doing. I think you're doing a great job.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming on today. I'm really glad you're here.
I truly appreciate it. I'm looking forward to talking more and working in the future.
Bring Thaddeus back.